Hello. Okay. I guess the mic is on. I think it's working. Yeah. Well, hi. I'm David DeCook. I'm the author of this book right here, Murder in the Stacks, Penn State, Betsy Yardsma, and the Killer Who Got Away. It just came out. That's good. Okay. I'm happy to be here tonight. I always enjoy talking to people who are interested in my books. Up till now, I've only done that on my books about the Centralia mine fire. There's one called Fire Underground, which I think they may have here also. But Murder in the Stacks has kept me busy for the past 6 years. But in another sense, it's kept me busy since I was 16 years old, 45 years ago. And that was because I grew up in the same hometown as Betsy Yardsma, Holland, Michigan. And we went to the same high school. We didn't know each other, but because she was 6 years older than I was. But we had teachers in common, and my younger sister knows her younger sister. So there was, it was a small town, Holland, maybe 25,000 at the time, and so that's where we grew up. It was Holland was a very unique town as small towns go. It was settled in the mid 1800s by Dutch religious dissidents from the Netherlands, and so my last name, De Cook, is Dutch, and so is Betsy Yardsma. Her name is Dutch as well, as is probably the name of 85% of the people in that town. And it's always been a fairly nice place to grow up, a little on the conservative side, but you're right by Lake Michigan, and they have good education there, and so it wasn't bad. But it could get a little bland and boring, and Betsy, very definitely, growing up in the 1960s, she felt constrained by living in Holland. She kind of wanted to break free, and fly away. And her parents kind of held her close to home for a while for the first 2 years of college. But then she transferred to the University of Michigan for her junior and senior years, and she, had a good experience there. She was a kind of person. I always like to say that Betsy Yardsma was the daughter that every parent wants to have, and she was the student that every school wants to be leading the class on graduation day. She graduated fourth in her class at Holland High School. As a sophomore, she had been number one in her class, so she was smart. There is no doubt about it. She was also pretty. She was, witty, intelligent. Men loved to talk to her. And she had no trouble attracting the attention of men, for better or for worse, in this case. In fact, when she was at the University of Michigan as a senior, Kurt Vonnegut, the author, showed up at a party at her house. He was the writer in residence for a short period in January of 1969, and she had met him, obviously had charmed him, and he just, all of a sudden, he showed up. He knew about the party. He came to the house with a six-pack of Guinness, which none of the girls that she lived with had ever seen before, and he stayed there. He signed his name on a poster on the wall, She was very friendly. She liked to meet new people, and I always like to say too that she was an early feminist. She was always challenging things. She initially wanted to be a physician, and she graduated from high school in 1965. In 1965, only 7% of medical students in the United States were women. It's obviously gotten much better since then, but back then, it was a sexist profession. It was hard. If you were going to be a woman and succeed as a doctor, you really had to have some gumption, to stay with it. And so she did stay with it for 1 year. I always like to say she was a sometimes successful feminist. She often ran up against the societal constraints, and she didn't always succeed in getting past them. And this was one case where she just decided that it was much easier to go into a field that was much more female-oriented, meaning art and English, English language and literature. So after her first year at Hope College, where she started out college in Holland, Michigan, she never took another science course after that and concentrated on English and art. So she really wanted, I mean, she had been influenced by missionaries that came to her Reformed church in Holland about the outside world. She wanted to help the outside world, and so she got the idea that she wanted to join the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps and the University of Michigan had a long and tight relationship. In 1960, when then-Senator John F. Kennedy was running for president, he made a famous speech on the U of M campus. They have a plaque there today where he stood, and he called for the creation of a Peace Corps, something that would send idealistic young Americans out to foreign countries to help them, you know, develop, you know, their education, their health care, you know, that sort of thing. So she decided that's what she wanted to do after she graduated from U of M. And she applied, and she was accepted, you know, into the Peace Corps. She was going to have an assignment in Sierra Leone in West Africa. But, you know, and I mentioned that she ran up against constraints and societal expectations. Her boyfriend did not want her to go. Her boyfriend was a medical student, you know, the theoretical, you know, great catch, you know, for a young woman back then. And he basically told her, if you go in the Peace Corps, I can't guarantee that I'll be here when you get out after your two-year, you know, tour of duty, you know, in Africa. So she thought about it and thought about it, and she gave it up. And she decided that she would go to grad school and in English. And she was a good English student. She was not at the top of her, you know, class, but right comfortably up there. And so she had decide then which school to go to. And Michigan had a great graduate program in English. You know, she could have done very well, you know, there. But at that time, in the spring and summer of 1969, there was a serial killer killing young women on the University of Michigan and the Eastern Michigan University campuses. These were brutal, awful, you know, murders. You know, if you think of Hannibal Lecter, you know, and some of the things you saw, you know, in some of those movies, John Norman Collins was very much like that. John Norman Collins was also known as the co-ed killer. And what really scared Betsy's parents was that he targeted pretty brunettes. And that's what Betsy was. Now, Betsy was different, too, because she was 5'8", and most of the girls that Collins killed were closer to, you know, between 5 and 5'4". You know, so there was a definite, you know, difference there. But, you know, if you're a parent, you know, of a pretty brunette daughter, you're not going to really necessarily make that distinction, you know. And so they wanted her to follow her boyfriend David to Penn State, where he had been accepted into the new medical school that had just been opened at Hershey. And so she applied late but got in, and then she was accepted to the English graduate program at Penn State, and off they went for the last 10 weeks of her life. Now, she was always open to meeting new men, but to meet them as friends, not as lovers necessarily. And so she would, you know, if somebody asked her to go out, you know, for coffee or whatever like that, she would often accept. And when, you know, Richard Hafner, who was a fellow, you know, resident of Atherton Hall at Penn State, and Atherton was Penn State's first co-ed dorm, and I believe this was the first year that it was a co-ed dorm. Now, they lived in different parts of the building, obviously, but they did live in the same, you know, hall, and that's more than likely how Hafner got to know her. So they went out maybe three times for essentially for coffee, maybe once for bowling, I think, maybe. She decided that he was a creep, told her family as much, and basically cut things off. Well, Hafner, you should also know, was a pedophile. And he was a bad, bad pedophile. He had already been accosted. He had been caught as a pedophile in Lancaster, PA, which is where he was from, as early as age 19 when he was a student at Franklin and Marshall College. And these were documented incidents that I was able to get documents on from through the Right to Know Act. And he was attracted to 8 to 12-year-old boys, and he did it throughout his life. Now, you might ask yourselves, why would he be interested in Betsy if he was a boy-oriented pedophile? Well, the answer is he sought out women as cover for what he was. And you see this throughout his life. And he would just he would strike up friendships. He also had a very high opinion of his intellectual abilities. You know, he was later on he would insist that people call him Dr. Richard Hafner after he got his PhD in geology from Penn State. And but you know, he thought Betsy was on the same level as him, worthy of his attention. And when she cut him off, he was not a happy camper. And this was around the time that it was around in November, you know, probably early November of 1969. And Betsy was commuting back and forth from Hershey every week to see David, you know, and then toward, you know, the beginning of November, the relationship became more serious, and they started talking about getting married. And along comes, you know, Thanksgiving holiday. And they got together down in Hershey. They and some of the other med students, you know, had a Thanksgiving dinner. At that time, the med school's housing was unused houses from the Milton Hershey School. And so, anyway, they spend this couple of days and a night, you know, together. And as David Wright told me, it was. They weren't necessarily engaged, but they were kind of engaged to be engaged. And he, the way he put it, he said, you know, we probably would have been shopping for rings, and she may have gotten a ring, you know, at Christmas time. But she comes back on the day after Thanksgiving, and the gets up, you know, on the morning of the 29th, you know, gets dressed, and she has a lot of work to do at school. Now, somewhere along the way, during that time period, I believe Hafner, you know, may have run into her, you know, may have tried to talk her up again, and she shot him down, and may have said something like, you know, I'm engaged, or, you know, words to, you know, to that effect. Well, anyway, she heads off to Petit Library. She and the other members of the English 501 graduate English class, they all had papers to do. You know, so there were several of her classmates, you know, in the library that afternoon, and she ran into some of them. You know, one was Marilee Eardley, a girl from Aliquippa, and there was another guy by the name of Larry Paul Maurer, you know, who was there, and there were other students too, you know, who were not part of that English class, but sometime around right before 5 o'clock. She had the fatal encounter with her killer, the man who I believe, for a number of reasons, was Richard Hafner. And he probably had been reading porn and engaging in certain sexual activities of a solo variety, you know, in the library there, because they found a lot of evidence of that, you know, afterwards. And she was looking for a book. And he seems to have cornered her in between the two rows of books. Now the stacks of Petit Library where this took place are, the rows are narrow, they're dimly lit, and two people cannot pass without one turning sideways, between the two rows of books. So I've often believed that She could only have been approached, because there was no scream. There was no scream at all. She could only have been approached by someone she knew, someone who could get past the flight and fear, you know, reflex. Now, she didn't like Hafner. She thought he was a creep, but I don't think she thought that he was dangerous. But in any case, he approached her. And then we switch over to Marilee Erdley and a Mozambican student by the name of Joao Afinda, who were standing maybe 15 to 20 feet away. And there was a third witness, an older man, who was there visiting his son and was using the copier down in the library right about that time. And all of a sudden, they hear something. Or one of them, Mr. Allen, hears a sound kind of like that. And maybe somebody heard a gasp, maybe not, but there was no scream. And then a few seconds later, there was the sound of books crashing to the floor, which she had pulled down as her body fell after having been stabbed. And she was only stabbed once, right in the breastbone. It went right through. If you know your anatomy at all, the breastbone is there for a reason. It's to protect the heart, which is right behind it. And whoever drove that in, and again, I believe it was Richard Hafner, had to basically intend to do what he was doing. It's not an easy thing. You just have to, you know, jam it in there, you know, and that's what he did. And, you know, she was probably essentially dead by the time she hit the floor. But because of the nature of this wound, she didn't bleed to any you know, great extent whatsoever, not like you the movies would have you believe. And this was even outside of the movies, this was an odd incident, because there was no blood on the floor. There were no real blood stains on her shirt, except, I mean, if you had opened them up, you would have seen a little bit of blood. But because the entrance wound was so narrow, there was really no good avenue for the blood to escape her body. And so, anyway, they Marilee Erdley, you know, went over to see what the noise was, and Joao Afinda. Oh, I forgot one important thing. Right after they heard those books crash to the floor, a man comes racing out of the stacks. He was fairly well dressed, with a sports jacket and khaki pants, probably wearing glasses. You know, on the young side, but not a totally young student. You know, probably another graduate student. And he looks at Erdley and Wafinda and says, "Somebody had better help that girl." But it wasn't going to be him. You know, he kept on going. And Wafinda, whose native language was Portuguese, his English was only so-so. He thought he heard the man say, "We've got to help the girl." So he follows him, you know, trots after him. But Hafner escapes, and he gets out of the library. He may have been seen running across the front of the library. Nobody really knows. But at the, you know, the librarians had heard the noise of the books falling, coming up through the grating in the floor. They came down to investigate, and by that time, Marilee Erdley was kneeling next to Betsy, quite agitated, quite upset, and they thought that she was only passed out. They thought that she had an epileptic seizure, and so they call the ambulance from Rittenhour, you know, Health Clinic at Penn State. And I guess they're pretty quickly, because it's barely a 5-minute walk, even from the library, and so they bring the stretcher down there, and they take her to Rittenhour Health Clinic, and that's where they discover that she's dead, you know, and she's been stabbed to death, and by that time, you know, probably half an hour, you know, had passed. It would be another 60 minutes beyond that before the first state trooper arrived on the scene, and he's actually with us tonight, Mike Simmers, and right there, yeah. He was just a young 23-year-old trooper at the time, just a year older than Betsy Yarzma, and he was the first one there, and then things kind of moved on, you know, from that. Now Hafner, an hour after the murder, shows up at the home of his thesis advisor, Professor Loren Wright. He was a geology professor, and for a time he was chairman of the department. And Wright lived in the southwest corner of State College and on Ronan Drive. And Hafner knocks on the door, and Wright opens it, and Hafner says, "Do you know anything about, is there anything in the paper about that girl being killed in the library?" Well, it only happened an hour before that, and there wasn't any news that night until, 11 p.m. And so Wright doesn't say anything. Now, he told me, this is late in his life, he claimed that he told his dean, Charles Hostler, the next morning. In fact, it was 7 years until he told Hostler. And that was only after Hafner had behaved in the threatening, manner toward him. So Hostler then, he goes and tells Del McQuaid, the university general counsel, as soon as he can, get a hold of him. And McQuaid was the consummate insider at Penn State. He had been general counsel for most of his career. He knew everything and everyone there. He was arguably even more important than the university president. And McQuaid, apparently, if he told anybody, he didn't tell the state police. Now, Sergeant George Keebler, who was the lead investigator, of the murder for the Pennsylvania State Police during the first 14 years after it happened, he said, "I never heard anything from McQuaid." Without drawing too heavy a parallel, what does this remind you of? I think you get my point. My editor told me not to put any Sandusky references in the book, that it would distract from, everything, the story I was trying to tell. And I agree. But I worked it in a couple little times, So anyway, and then Loren Wright, went on, and he basically told other people the same story, that he believed that Hafner, he knew that Hafner carried a knife, and it was a homemade, it wasn't like a knife you would buy in a store, it was a homemade shiv, more or less, that Hafner had carried for self-protection ever since he was at McCaskey High School in Lancaster. And he always carried it, he put a little piece of tape on the end so he wouldn't nick himself, So he had the weapon, and Wright believed that he had probably killed, Betsy Arzma. And he told one of his former students when he ran into him in the early 1990s, told him the same story. But Loren Wright never picked up the phone and called the Pennsylvania State Police. This could have all ended a long time ago, but for whatever reason, and I really wonder, whether Hafner had something on Loren Wright that he was afraid would come out. He never did what he should have done as a citizen. He never notified the authorities that he believed that Rick Hafner had been the killer, of Betsy Arzma. So Penn State both, helped the investigation in terms of finances. They paid for things like bringing a hypnotist in, to hypnotize Marilee Eardley and Joawa Finda to see if they could bring more details out of what they had seen, that day. And this was an investigation that in 1969 cost about $250,000. And probably, in today's money, that would be closer to, to $1 million. So it was not an insignificant, a chunk of change that was spent, on this investigation. The state police interviewed many, many students and faculty, 2,500 or more in all. There were 40 troopers, on the Penn State campus for over a month, doing all these interviews. They would talk to anybody they thought might, know something. And one of the problems that they faced at the time, and this was almost the same problem that the Michigan State Police faced in investigating the co-ed killings in Ann Arbor, was that the students, there was a high level of distrust of the state police because of the anti-war and civil rights protests that had been held on the campus since about 1967 on, and particularly in 1968 and 69. You know, there was a segment of the students, not all, but a significant number, who saw the state police as occupying army, you know, pigs. You know, now there were other Penn State students who were not like that at all. There were a significant number of conservative students, you know, on campus who had no problem with the state police. But people were not coming forward with information. You know, if they were called in, they'd answer the questions and everything, but people were not coming in on their own to talk to the state police. You know, and Lieutenant Kimmel, who was George Keebler's superior, complained publicly about this. You know, he said, you know, please, we're not here to do anything else. We're just here to investigate this murder, you know, but nothing helped. And they were also, now Hafner was one of the ones who was interviewed. And it never rose above the routine, you know, that they, you know, and so he did not get on anybody's radar screen, you know, at the time. But another student by the name of Larry Paul Maurer, who is from Herndon, did. Maurer was an odd character. It was almost like he was bound and determined to make the state police believe that he had been Bessie Yarsma's killer. When two troopers went to his dorm room in Atherton to interview him, you know, it was just a routine, you know, interview. You know, one of them's talking to Maurer, and the other one happens to notice Maurer's desk chair in his room, a wooden desk chair. And on the arm, he had carved, "Here sits death in the guise of man." And, you know, the state trooper was like, whoa, you know, and so they asked, you know, Maurer about that, and he said, oh, I just thought it was a cool saying. And Maurer confessed that, yes, he did routinely carry a knife, but he used it to cut cheese. And, you know, so it was like he wanted to get caught. You know, there was one thing, I put this in the book originally, but it kind of got edited out, but there was a character in the movie, The Boston Strangler, which came out around that time, and was actually playing on a second or third run in State College during the investigation. There was a character in that who behaved very much like Maurer did. You know, just a man, he was a young man, contemptuous of the police, you know, taunting them, you know, trying to get their attention, you know, and I just had to wonder, I mean, did Maurer see this and get his idea from that, or was it just, you know, something within him? But they even put Maurer, you know, on a lie detector, a polygraph. He passed with flying colors, you know, so there was nothing they could do. And so they just sent him on his way. He left Penn State almost immediately, ended up in the National Security Agency, and then comes back into the story about, you know, 30 years down the line. But Hafner just was dumb lucky. You know, he was an awful person, just awful. You know, the pedophilia continued. He was arrested by the Lancaster police in 1975 and accused of molesting two boys who worked for him in his rock shop. He had a shop next to his parents' house where he built these rock sample boxes that he sold to the Smithsonian, which then resold them in their gift shop. And he would hire neighborhood boys, you know, to make these rock boxes. And these two boys, and he was always looking for boys to molest. I mean, it was just the way that he was. And this time he got caught. And the Lancaster police, you know, they, unlike whatever had happened, you know, before, you know, when he was 19 years old, or even a little bit older. And he was a Boy Scout leader too. I hate to mention that, but he was, you know, and yes, you know, he wasn't in the files that were released because it was a little bit too early for that. But you know, it's just, you know, all the stereotypical bad stuff that pedophiles do, he did it. He beat the rap because the jury deadlocked 11-1. One guy would not vote for conviction, as I'm told by one of the other jurors. This guy has, you know, had said he didn't trust the Lancaster police or some such thing. And anyway, so the judge declares a mistrial. And Hafner then, it's not certain whether his lawyer quit or whether, you know, Hafner fired him, but Hafner then goes to Philadelphia and hires Richard Sprague as his lawyer. I don't know if that name means anything to anybody, you know, here or not, but Dick Sprague is one of the high-powered Philadelphia lawyers, former prosecutor, and, he's a good lawyer. There's no doubt about it. And he found a path to a successful appeal that got Hafner off by persuading the Pennsylvania appellate courts that the judge had not tried hard enough to get the jury to, you know, come in with a unanimous verdict. So Hafner got off and forever after would tell people that he was exonerated. He was really, an all-around nasty person. He loved to sue people. He had discovered that you didn't really need a lawyer to file a lawsuit against people, that it was easy enough to fill out the paperwork yourself and prosecute the case in court. He never won any of these cases that he filed himself, but that didn't matter for the people that he was suing. They still had to hire lawyers and pay a lot of money to defend themselves to avoid a default judgment. You know, and the courts, and I think this is probably true of, you know, courts in many places, but the judges in Lancaster County just kind of did not seem to notice what was going on in front of their eyes. You know, they didn't make any effort really to stop Hafner, you know, from filing these frivolous lawsuits that were, you know, ruining people's lives. You know, and with the family, the Berkey family, one of the boys who's now dead, Kevin Berkey, was one of the boys he molested in 1975. He sued members of that family for nearly 20 years. You know, and it took that long before the last of the lawsuits, you know, was thrown out. You know, and it was just a travesty, you know, of misuse of the court system. It was just awful. And Hafner, but, you know, he thought he was just vindicating himself, you know, but I think he had to know that of what he was really doing. But anyway, later he later moved out to Death Valley, California, which is where he had done his graduate work as a Penn State student. And he lived there toward the end of his life. That was where he died. Lauren Wright and Lauren Wright's buddy, Benny Troxell, were with him within days of when he died. Lauren Wright never cut off contact with him. And another strange thing. And so he died of a heart attack. He initially survived, and they took him to by ambulance to a hospital in Las Vegas, which is the closest big city to Shoshone, California, in Death Valley. And he was there for a couple of days, and he had a second heart attack. Basically, the heart blew out the scab on the original, you know, heart attack, and he just bled out, as I say, much like Betsy Arzma had. Hafner became known to me and to others around 2010. His cousin, Christopher Hafner, who was younger, had, and who for a long time adored Rick. You know, he thought Rick was cool, you know, and Rick had that, I mean, as many pedophiles do, he could charm kids, you know, and But Chris eventually found out the hard way, what Rick was all about. But Rick had overheard a conversation between Rick and his mother after Rick had been arrested on those Lancaster charges in 1975. And Era Hafner, Rick's mother, who Chris described as saying, "If Rick had brought home Betsy's body in the trunk of his car, Era would have helped him bury it." And so she came screaming out of the house, you know, yelling at Rick, "Why did you do this again? is, you know, it's just like you did when you killed that girl at Penn State. And, you know, and this went on for a little while, and then Rick is like pushes her back into the house, you know, and then later realizes that Chris had overheard the whole thing. And then, of course, he's just like very calm and nice as pie and everything. And over the next several days and several weeks, tried to persuade Chris that he hadn't heard what he had heard, and that whatever he heard, that he really hadn't killed Betsy, but he knew who did. You know, and then he was talking about how Betsy was really not the, you know, the great person everybody said. She was just out to get a man. That's all she was at college for, was to get a man, you know. So, that became known. Actually, Haefner had been known or suspected as early as the 1980s. There was a woman who wrote a book, or set out to write a book about the case, and ended up writing a novel because she was scared of getting sued, you know, by people who were still alive at that time. But she first heard the story about the geology graduate student who had showed up at his professor's house an hour after the murder. And Sasha Skucik, who was at that time an English lecturer at Penn State's main campus, did a number of articles about the case over the past 10 years. And he eventually also concluded that Haefner, you know, was the killer of Betsy Arzma. In fact, he persuaded Trooper Lee Barrows, who was at that time, she was the investigator assigned to the Arzma case. He persuaded her that Haefner was, you know, the killer too. And in the summer of 2010, she told the Arzma family that, in fact, you know, that while they might never be able to close the case, that they did, that they believe that Haefner was Betsy's killer. And I heard about this almost right away. It was kind of an odd thing, funny almost. Betsy's younger sister, Kathy, had gone out to her high school class reunion in Holland around that time. And she was telling people at the class reunion that, you know, my sister's murder has been finally solved. And one of them went to hairdresser in Holland and was telling her about this. And the hairdresser was the sister of one of my sources for the book. And so, you know, within hours, you know, I got an email, you know, that, you know, I heard this, and then I emailed a friend of mine who was also a friend of Kathy Arzma's, and she told me more, you know, and that's when I decided to turn what had just been a newspaper series that went in a very different direction about the case. I decided to turn all that, you know, into the book that we have here now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Okay. The head of the library knew he had a problem in the library in 1969. There had been fires set that appeared to be related to political activities. You know, fires that could have had a devastating effect. But even more so, there was all sorts of vice in the library. You know, co-eds being, you know, touched, hassled, assaulted, you know, by unknown men, you know, in Petit Library. And Carl Jackson, pleaded with Colonel Bill Pelton, the head of the Department of Security, said, we've got to have, you know, permanent security in here. You know, there's too much stuff going on. And, you know, and Pelton refused. He said, I can't give you any more priority than I give, you know, any other building, you know, on campus. And he just looked at it as a very narrow-minded, you know, bureaucrat. And so they went back and forth, and Pelton refused to assign any of the campus patrol, you know, to the library on a regular basis. They would sometimes be there, but they were subject to being called away for, you know, traffic duty or whatever, you know. And Jackson wanted somebody there all the time, you know, during the entire period that the library, you know, was open. Pelton refused. And so Jackson then repurposed part of his budget. And they found enough money to hire two security guards. And that was enough to cover part of the time that the library was open, basically from 8 to midnight. And of course, the murder happened at 5:05, you know. And it was just... It was just an incredible story, and I never would have known this except for a friend of mine from years ago, Chet Davis, who was a Penn State grad, dug a copy of this obscure Penn State campus magazine called Focus out of his basement. You know, and his friend, the guy who wrote the article, had been the guy who wrote, you know, the editor of Focus, And this guy had written an article about the Ardsma case, an in-depth article, in 1972. Yeah, it was 1972. So only 3 years afterward, when memories were still fairly fresh. And he talked to Jackson. You know, he talked, you know, to other members of the Department of Security, not to Pelton, apparently. But and it was a fascinating article and a total find, because a lot of this stuff had been forgotten and was not available, because nearly all of the documents that Penn State should have on the Ardsma murder are nowhere to be found. There is a little file about this thick in the campus archives about the murder. Most of it is press releases. There's nothing substantive. I mean, to be honest, you know, and I've done archival research for years and years and years. There should be this many documents. I'm not making this up. There should be that many documents, you know, on that murder. You know, letters from parents who were concerned about whether it was still safe for their kids to be at Penn State. Reports to President Walker of Penn State, you know, as to what's going on. I mean, you had 40 troopers on campus for over a month interviewing more than 2,500 people, and you're telling me that there's no documents about this anywhere. You know, it just does not stand to reason. You know, either they were removed or they never got there. Now, the reason that I was able to find as much as I did, in addition to the article from Focus, was that there were documents in the archives, in the library files, that had been overlooked, I think, in this purge, because they didn't directly mention the Ardsma investigation. But they were very much related, you know, to it. And so those proved, you know, to be very helpful. And so, yeah, that's the backstory that Ed refers to. Yes? It's circumstantial, you know. I mean, there could well still be somebody out there who knows something, but, you know, unless they come forward, we're never going to know. Yes?
One of the things I enjoyed most about the book was how you pulled from so many different places and areas and almost digressions at times, but then pulled it all together into this overall narrative. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your research methods on how you were able to gather this information.
Okay. One thing I did was file freedom of information requests with the FBI for everybody that was associated with this story who might have an FBI file. And that's actually more people than you'd think. President Walker of Penn State had a nice, thick, you know, FBI file. He was a good friend of J. Edgar Hoover, too. You know, he thought Hoover was the greatest. And Hoover had a confidential informant in Walker's office. The name was, excised out, but one of the documents referred to a report they received from a confidential informant in President Walker's office. And there was a great file on Mary Willard, who was kind of the Miss Marple of Penn State. She was a great early CSI investigator who was on the Penn State faculty. She was a chem prof. And she was, for lack of a better term, an old maid. Her father, Willard Hall at Penn State, is named after her father. And there was a nice FBI file on her in which, everybody was praising her abilities and how the FBI did not think much of the Pennsylvania State Police's crime lab in Harrisburg at that time. And they talked about how, the police in the State College area would try to come up with excuses to have Mary Willard, do their CSI work rather than having to bring somebody up from Harrisburg, to do it. So those provided some interesting, bits of information. I also found all the court cases relating to Hafner that I could find in the National Archives, from the federal courts, and some state court cases too. One of those, laid out the incident. I forgot to mention this. In 1998, he badly beat a woman in a parking lot in Delaware who had challenged him. Hafner had a very he reacted very poorly when women challenged him, and he had left his sick old dog in a shopping cart outside this liquor store while he went in to shop, and some women came along and saw this and were upset. They didn't know that the dog was his, and so they talked among themselves and they were going to take it to a vet, to keep it there until they could find the real owner. And anyway, Hafner came out and starts freaking out and ends up dragging one of the women out of her car, punching her, bashing her face against the car, caused her $32,000 in dental damage. And this was all laid out in one of the federal lawsuits that was filed by Hafner. And of course, in response, to that. So that was another source. And then, of course, newspapers. Newspapers are the great first draft of history. You can all, that was one of the ways that I was able to, get details about the campus unrest at Penn State in the late 1960s. Was from, the State College newspaper, the Altoona paper, the Collegian, And then also, I found an interesting cache of documents in the state archives in Governor Ray Schaefer's papers. They were a set of reports filed by the state police from their undercover informants within the SDS at Penn State, detailing everything that was going on. I interviewed the Penn State SDS president at the time, during part of this, and he was quite surprised to hear that he had been so totally infiltrated like that. It was just a whole lot of different things. You just try to, look wherever you can to find something that relates to what you're writing about, and you just weave it into a master narrative. Yes. I suppose the thought had crossed my mind, but it didn't become serious until the summer of 2010 when, I got that word. Yeah. Yes. No, because I don't have access to it. They will not allow non-law enforcement to read their files. Sure like to, but but no. Yeah. That was so really, this was a book that defended heavily on interviews. Sergeant George Keebler, the lead investigator from the Pennsylvania State Police, lead investigator of the Arizona murder between 1969 and 1983, when he retired. We sat down for 7 or 8, long interviews. He was great. Great memory. He's 84 now, still very healthy. So he was a great help. Mike Simmers was a great help, especially in locating people. I ended up talking to all of the state troopers who were involved in the investigation that I could find who were still alive. Some were better than others, but I always say, everybody has one good fact that they can tell you, about something. And so, even if I talk to somebody for an hour and I only get one good fact, I'm still happy. Yeah. Yes. Rest and relaxation. No decisions yet on a future book. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think I'll keep those to myself for now. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes. Yes. Rachel Taylor. Yeah. What's that? That's right. Again, no access to the police documents, but there were a number of newspaper articles about it, over a long period of years. At one point, an inmate, I think it was in Oklahoma, confessed to that murder. It was a bogus story, That's how I wrote about Rachel Taylor. And another point I wanted to make, people say, Penn State didn't do so well on this, doesn't do so well on some other things. But what really struck me, in going through this was, this look the other way attitude, was so prevalent there for so many years. In addition to, to Betsy Arizmo and, of course, to, Jerry Sandusky, there was another pedophile professor, there by the name of Antonio Lasaga. In 1981, the Patton Township Police outside of State College arrested him for molesting two boys at the Park Forest pool, and his colleagues helped him get out of it. They may have helped pay off the families. A lot of this was in the police records, which I was able to get in this instance, from the Patton Township Police, and then Charlie Hostler and some other people also, told me some things about that case. Lasaga was a young genius. He taught in the geosciences. Everybody praised his intellect, and they thought he was a great guy. Had a lovely wife and family. But he was a pedophile, and he left Penn State, I think it was in 1984, to go to Yale. And he got to, and he spent quite a few years at Yale. And then in 1999, he was arrested when they found 150,000 images of child pornography on his university computer. And then he was also accused of having a long-term molestation relationship with a 13-year-old boy from New Haven who he had met in a mentoring program. Lasaga was put on trial by both the federal and the state governments in Connecticut, two of his Penn State colleagues came to testify as character witnesses and urged the judge not to imprison him because it would be a loss to science. And the judge was just slack-jawed. I mean, it was even in the papers, that people were just like, how can you be so obtuse, about this? But that's how they were. And the one guy is still that way today. Lasaga was sentenced to 15 years on the federal charge, the federal child pornography charge, and then 20 years on the Connecticut state charge for molesting the boy. He finishes his federal term next February, I believe it is, and then it's unclear whether he'll now have to, transfer to a Connecticut state prison, to finish that sentence. But the stuff just goes on and on. I really think there should be a truth commission appointed to go into all of these scandals, an independent truth commission that cannot be manipulated, by the various powers that be, and just try to get to, the bottom of this, and let them move on from there. I like to point out, this is the last thing I'm going to say, is, not every university acts like this. 1950, a Franklin and Marshall student, Eddie Gibbs, murdered a young woman who was a clerk at the college. He was not caught for a while, but eventually he was. Franklin and Marshall cooperated in every way, every significant way, right up till he was taken into custody. And they did this even while knowing that it did not make the college necessarily look good, and there was a high likelihood, which indeed was the case, that Gibbs would be convicted and executed. And he was executed in 1951 in the Pennsylvania electric chair. So Franklin and Marshall did the right thing. They moved on, Penn State could have taken a lesson from that. Thank you.